Hey, Real Nerds listeners, there's many ways you can interact with the Real Nerds podcast. You can email us at realnerds@gmail.com. You can hit us on Twitter at Real Nerds. You want to check us on Facebook? You can. Just look for Real Nerds Podcast. You want to leave us a voicemail? Just call 720-6NERDS5. You want to listen to our episodes? You can check us out on Stitcher, iTunes, Spotify, and iHeartRadio. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Camera, action!
Well, a real nerd knows who shot, and a real nerd can follow the plot, and a real nerd can...
Sorry.
Take it outside.
Well, a real nerd knows who shot. A real nerd can follow the plot. And a real nerd will give out all the gods. Lights, camera, action. Real nerds.
Welcome back to Real Nerds Podcast. I am your sometimes host, Zach, and with me is your much more regular presence on the show, Mr. Brad.
I'm here.
Brad, who are we here to talk to? What are we doing here? What are we doing here?
We're doing a real interview with a filmmaker.
Woo! Ooh, would it happen to be the director of a film that features one of the best puppet fights I've ever seen in my life?
I hope so.
All right. Well, I if that's the case, then I think we have the right gentleman in the studio. Please welcome Mr. Nick Roth.
I am so happy to be here and be associated with a puppet fight as my main bullet point.
Very few people have it. And Happy Time Murders.
Not enough.
And Happy Time Murders disappointed me so grandly that this made up for it.
Okay. Yeah. So, that's what we're hoping to do. We're really hoping to make up for the entire Puppet Master franchise.
Look, Brian Henson had one job to do, which is make a movie as magical and dirty as his father might have made it. And he just failed. But you succeed in the place that he failed. I have a question to kick this off, because there's a couple of things I noticed about the film with watching a screener in advance.
Okay.
What gave you the inclination to pursue a story this surreal? Like, what was the genesis of this?
Well, this is just how my stupid brain works. I don't know. I wish I had an answer for you that was like, we really wanted to plumb the depths of weirdness, but I was like, oh, it's a napkin, and the napkin can talk. And then, you know, from that, everything sort of like falls out from that. If you got a talking napkin, well, he's going to get off on cleaning up messes, right? Like, that's what else is a napkin going to be turned on by? You know, that just makes sense. So it's actually quite logical. Like, once you just sort of, I don't think of it as surreal, you know, I'm just trying to make it make sense.
I think that the entirety has a surreal functionality to it in the way you're playing with your visual spectrum, how you're playing with this ice shack with it's so small on the outside and big on the inside, like a TARDIS. The mushroom sequence in general, like those are just like lovely things that I appreciate of a film that's not afraid to kind of go off into the irreverent. So when did the origin of it begin? Like, when did you come up with this idea? Like, because I saw that you made a short of this prior.
The most of us who were involved in the feature had worked on the short, a bunch of us at least. And the short was really a very innocent, sort of much more like maybe PG-13 story about like a guy and his talking napkin being on a date, and they're on, you know, it's a sort of unlikely romance. But then the idea was we go underneath the table where you get both napkins talking to each other. And they sort of, you know, are somehow representative of the like, the id or the unconscious or whatever you want to say is like the awkwardness of a date sort of through the eyes of like what's on your lap. Right. But there's no, you know, murder and mayhem and gore and nudity and, you know, all the things that we then were like, well, once we get to a feature, now finally we can have this napkin, you know, have an epic wire food duel and all the things that you want to have in the short.
Right. So when you come to the feature film realm, your next step point was basically to kind of pull into a interdimensional horror film.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I love an alien invasion movie, and it's not, they're not easy to pull off with puppets and no money, but you know, we did our best.
I think you absolutely succeeded at the goal there, because like something that I like about it is, well, one, the interdimensional aspect isn't until the third of the film. We may have to put a spoiler for to get the buff, because I don't want to.
It's totally fine. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think this isn't a movie that really relies on twists and plots to get you through it. You know what I mean? It's a comedy. It's funny. And I think it's funny. It's just as funny if you know where it's going, even though you probably don't.
Absolutely. Well, actually, I didn't. I knew that we were dealing, when I saw the trailer, I knew we were dealing with the napkin and the hat. But I wasn't incredibly aware of where it was going to go. Even at the midway point, when you have the Chardonnay drinking cabin dweller talking with the napkin in the bathroom, I'm still like, okay, something's off here. I don't know exactly what's going to happen. I do know that something different is going to happen than what I thought was going to happen in my head. My thought initially was Evil Dead, but with a hat, with sentient hat. And it completely managed to twist my expectations, not the least of which with adding a government organization, which I love the line akin to the Men in Black.
Yeah, it's not the Men in Black. It's just, you know, but that's like, I feel like this is a pet peeve and a hobby horse of mine is like people in movies always act like they haven't seen all the movies because you don't want to like overly reference movies. It's like, but the actual CIA agents, they're talking about Men in Black all the time. You think they haven't seen these movies? Like, that's probably that's their language. Right. And so like, I appreciate in movies, I try to write it, is that like, this is how we talk, as we say, oh, it's like in this movie. Mm-hmm. Where whatever. So when she's going to go explain to them who she is, she's like, it's basically Men in Black. You know what I mean? Like, just assume it's that, you know what that is. Everybody knows.
It's better than having a grander idea of the mythos you're creating. Like, you're not J.R.R. Tolkien. You're not trying to build like a mythology for England. You are very much trying to get us from point A to point B to make that point. Now I did have a couple questions about the way you made the film. Like, first of all, like, it's an independent film. It looks like you guys had a lot of fun making it. Can you talk about the process of not just writing the script, but directing it with Lindsay Hahn, your co-director?
Yeah, I mean, this was first of all, it's very, very collaborative. Like, I'm taking the writer's credit. I guess I wrote the draft, but like, everybody really had a hand in writing and crafting it. We all kind of just made this thing together. We like, the whole cast, basically the main cast, and Lindsay and I we really wrote the movie, developed the idea, did all of that together. We all stayed in the cabin, and we all were living in this tiny little cabin while we made the movie. And then like a lot of the stories just sort of like fell out from like, I don't know, we'll kill people in the order that we have the availability of actors. I think that makes the movie kind of unpredictable, because it's like, When you sit down to write a script, and this was also, I wrote this so long ago, it was early in my screenwriting career. I know so much what I'm doing now, but I definitely didn't know then. So it was like, between those things, I don't think there's any, no one could predict where the movie goes, because it doesn't like follow a lot of the rules of screenwriting. And partly that's because it's like, oh, well, we're losing Azure in 2 days. So we gotta, that character's gotta die fast. I die fast because I was needed in directing the film.
Yeah.
So
I wanted to touch on that, because you play there's a couple of characters that each of the characters has a standout moment, but your character and your character's like love interest that's being kept locked behind a door. It was very refreshing to watch this kind of like this falutin intellectual in a robe. and I love how he doesn't get out of that robe really at all, even when he's outside.
Never. I think he's in it the whole. Well, no, Ed, did he dress? He puts on a cardigan for dinner, but other than that, he's in the robe the whole time.
Yeah, and it's just like, oh my god, that's commitment to this bit here of just this like, hey, and the whole hagiography is not an actual thing. Bit like did give me a nice little like each time it was being called out. But when you were directing as an actor, how does that work for you? Like, how do you balance those two?
Well, so it's co-directed with me. Lindsay and I co-directed, and you may notice that Dr. Crane and Rebecca are never in a scene together, which is by design, because we were like, we can't be in scenes together. One of us always. So at least there's somebody who's directing while the other one is acting. And we didn't really have a crew. Mm-hmm. Like, at all. Like we had at any given time, we had a DP and like maybe our friend Sam to hold the boom sometimes. And then that's like, that's basically it. And then we just had us and the cast. So, you know, the cast had to do their own sound, which is, I think maybe felt a little bit in the film. But yeah, I was like, we need bodies. It's a horror movie. People got to die. And so, everyone's got to be in it who's working on it, except for the directors of photography. They're the only ones who escaped that. We were like, we need somebody to be manning the camera at any given time. But everybody else, you got to be in the movie and you got to be on the crew.
So they didn't have to get splattered around with paint, blood makeup effects and whatnot.
Yeah. 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 They're the only ones who have escaped it so far.
Yeah. We can actually talk that transitions me into the way some folks get their demise. One of which is when they're wearing Harry the Hat. All that blood is trickling down.
Yeah.
I just liked how it was nice and inventive. Like you didn't need to go too far. It's just right there and it's just dripping down. It was like very, I got a nice little like, oh my God, like this is a nice like splatter fest going on right now.
There's just enough of it to, I think, be like a little like actual, like it catches you off guard. Maybe it's so creepy. There's a shout out is warranted here to Toby Bryan, who plays Norm. He's the voice of Woody. He did all the puppeteering. He's our special effects guy. So there's somewhere I have a video. I haven't published it yet, but there's a very funny video of Toby and I testing the blood bags inside the hat and just like putting a hat on our head quickly and having the blood go down to great, or like trying to figure out how much blood, how fast does the blood need to drip? Things you don't really think about until it was literally like the night before we were shooting whatever. And we were like, we got to figure out the blood effect.
Yeah. And it's you're right, because it does take you back for a second, because a good chunk of the first part of this movie is not really blood laden at all whatsoever. Like what's really going on. And then all of a sudden it kicks into high gear. And what I kind of noticed as I was watching it shift from those modes is that you were already from the get go blending a couple different films in here. And
oh, yeah.
Ashamed to do it through the score. I noticed the ones that I noticed off the top of my head were The Shining at the beginning.
Yeah.
And then I got a bit of a sense of other horror films, maybe a Raimi vibe off of that. And then I got this basically Howard Shore-esque Middle Earth score for the final fight and whatnot. Did you instruct the composer to just go all out and try to recreate some of those vibes when getting that music together?
Yeah, the composer is Jimmy Hahn, Lindsay Hahn's dad. And that's actually his cabin where, so the music was also composed in the cabin where we shot too. Right. So when we temped, we made a temporary score with the score from The Shining was a big piece of that always. And this was always sort of like Lindsay's initial idea for the movie as how she would approach it as a director was, it's The Shining, but if Leslie Nielsen was playing Jack. And so we were always like, okay, so The Shining is a big piece of it. It's a movie that's near and dear to all of our hearts. And if you're doing a sort of snowbound family murder movie, that's a big piece of where we were. I'm not sure if I used any Howard Shore in particular in the temp score, but it was always a really big sweeping orchestral.
Oral voices popping up and everywhere. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And Jimmy's fantastic and extremely versatile and can do just like anything. So I was like, I need you to do The Shining here. There's a little bit of this is got to get more like English patient over here. And then like, giant orchestral. I think I used, like some of the inspiration pieces I gave him were like music from the Star Wars video games, because they had that kind of like epic, fighty, gigantic. So this may be a little bit of John Williams in there, if not Howard Shore.
I'm actually curious because of that epic feel that you're underlaying in the final fight. It kind of has an overall question about how you as a director and how your special effects guy handled this. Talk a little bit about the puppetry and how you were basically kind of motivating yourselves around that function, because it's one thing to have a bunch of actors and get your shots off on and make your day. It's another to have this puppet element in the mix. How did that affect the way you guys were able to progress at a pretty reasonable rate? And like, how difficult was it to work within those confines?
Is death, I mean, look, having the puppets are very rudimentary, right? Because they don't even have really like moving parts. I mean, Woody, who's one of the main characters of the movie, is literally just a napkin, an unaltered, he is a napkin. But then there's a lot of things that we did to sort of bring him to life a little bit more. I think that Toby's sort of hand, I mean, Toby's a serious puppeteer and a real puppet builder. So it's not like it was just like, he's much better than if it was just me with my hand. Like, and I think Toby brought a lot of life to the character by doing, you know, live recording the voice with the movements, and Toby really got into the sort of hand of it. Mm-hmm. The other thing is a decision that was made between Lindsay, who was really working more closely with the DPs. I was more like the director, who is also the writer, who was working on trying to, I just wanted the movie to be funny. That was all I was focused on. Was just
actors, et cetera.
Funny. Can I get it to be funny?
Yeah. But
Lindsay and the DPs worked out this cool thing where they, you know, altered the shutter speed of the camera when we're on Woody. So it just subtly gives this kind of unreal effect just a little bit. And it changes the way that the camera is like catching movement. Mm. So there's like little tiny things like that that I thought were really cool. And then, look, there was at least one moment where we were moving so fast because it was puppets that we forgot to shoot Woody's close up. And that's a problem, too, because usually you have if you have a human actor, it's a lot harder to do that. You're like, OK, we need to turn around on, you know, Jacob or Ashley or whatever. But there was definitely a key moment in the film where we just never shot a close up of Woody and realize it's the moment at the end of the movie where he says the titular line of the film, "We got hanky panky." And so I had to like go reconstruct it by I managed to digitally remove like Harry from another moment where Woody was talking and then digitally zoom in and turn it into a close up. But like that's one unforeseen challenge of working with napkin puppets.
Right. Well, I with that puppetry in mind and the way you're affecting the shutter speed, that makes a lot of sense now hearing that, because it does feel in tune with the rest of the film. It doesn't feels like it's off to the side in terms of like the visuals don't shift strictly unless you, the director, or Lindsay as the director are saying so in the edit. Nothing is shifting from the visual spectrum you've already set up. And also you handled your Foley beautifully to match each movement that was clearly hitting with the best take that you had. It was very, very lovely to watch that. And the Harry puppet was a very lovely, surreal invention. That thing looked groggy as sin. It's absolutely fantastic to.
He's like Adam. He's actually have him right here. He's with me.
Oh no!
He's a little worse for wear. His peacock feather eyes have rotted off, but you know, he's still there. There's still I still have the gaffer's tape that holds the blood bags inside of his head. So
I love the function of the rim of the hat has the teeth inside of it like a jaw. Like,
yeah.
Very lovely little addition to the detail.
That's all Toby. Toby sort of made it. Isn't he? He was like, I'll give him that little bit of a tongue. And, you know, it's sort of like, you know, when you see it up close with the shutter speed, I forget if it's sped up or slowed down. I'm bad with technical stuff, but like it does give him a kind of like fun, creepy flair.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he fits right within that Ice Shack motif. And then when you have him placed upon other people's heads, that just gives off this amazing, like, it's already an unsettling image on top of what's going to be an unsettling performance from anybody who's wearing it and or anybody who's getting the wrath of him. I really appreciated that. From start to finish, how long has the film been, like, how long have you been constructing it up to this point? Was this like over the course of a year? How long did this take you to put together?
So we assembled the idea we developed it and wrote the script and sort of prepped really. That was only a few months. We shot it in like most of it was shot in 3 weeks. And then some of it, a couple weekends later were sort of pickups. And then Lindsay and I spent 7 years editing it because it was a real bear and we were doing it in our spare time. And so it took just an enormously long, I think the real tremendous, boon that we got out of that was that like this was a movie where that really benefited from us being able to sort of take a few months off here and there, come back with, I mean, take a year off maybe at one point and really come back with fresh eyes, because it's very hard to edit. Look, we had never edited a movie. We didn't know what we were doing. We were learning as we went a lot of it. We'd only edited shorts and music videos before this. And it's a lot. It's a lot. And we had to figure out what the movie was and really put it together in the cutting room. So we spent a long time doing that, and we finished it. We picture locked right before the writer's strike.
So then you sit down and wait.
Well, and then I did the color and sound and all that during the strike, actually.
Nice, nice. And so did you I appreciate you finding a benefit in taking that long to edit. Because most people I might encounter may not feel that way. They have a turnaround in their mind. But if it's something that you're dedicating your time and passion to, there's no time limit on that.
It was just the movie's not, it's not there yet, and it can get better. And, you know, it was mostly just cutting it shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter until it's this very crisp 86 minutes and change. Mm-hmm. But it took a lot to get to, and, you know, things came out and went back in, and there's a lot that's on the cutting room floor.
You're not only right about that crisp, tight 86. Let's put aside the puppets and the sci-fi and the horror elements here for a second. The first third of this reminded me of a screwball comedy, which I really, really appreciated. Like the editing is very, very tight. And these characters feel like they're walking in and out of a press office in His Girl Friday, the way they're kind of maneuvering in and out. I was very, very impressed by how you managed to kind of fit all of that in. Like, did you start off, I'm wondering actually just as an editor to editor, did you start off giving them a little more space and then realizing you had to compress it, or was that the idea from the get-go?
I mean, I think that we were from the get-go, we were trying to compress it, and then we compressed it as much as we could in performance, then we compressed it as much as we could in post, because it was all there was a lot of emphasis on Clue is a good example of sort cabin murder mystery, but also we wanted that incredibly quick. It's not, I hesitate to invoke Clue too much because there's pieces that are superficially very similar to Clue, but I think tonally we were going for a very different kind of humor than Clue, but with some of that fast talking and obviously murder mystery in a cabin, right? But you know, Clue is, we had jokes that were more Clue like jokes, wordplay jokes. Most of that we cut out. We were like, this is actually not the direction we want to go in. We want to have it be this sort of, weirdly, it's more grounded in a lot of ways. And it's kind of, I think it's really great to throw people in this. Okay, so here's this crazy thing, but then let's treat that realistically. And what would happen? What would really happen? How would you really react if this insane thing was happening?
You're not cranking it to total ludicrous speed, essentially, if we were using Lux terminology. You're not going to ludicrous speed. You're maybe going toward ridiculous speed. And there's a definite, I got Clue vibes, but it was a larger drawing room mystery aesthetic at large.
Yeah.
You could apply that to how Rian Johnson's pulling off his Knives Out films recently, where it's a bunch of people in a room. We are trying to figure out what's going on here. Different relationships are being formed in and out of the cabin. And there's something about the speed of it that worked very well without going into a full 500% of Clue.
Right.
The speed is exactly where it needs to be.
A thing that's always on my mind structurally is Jurassic Park, which is there's a cold Jurassic Park opens. You don't see the raptor, but you see a guy get killed, right? This isn't reinventing the wheel, but then, then there's 45, 50 minutes, I think, after that where there's no violence. There's nothing bad that happens. There's some eeriness or whatever, but it's all just character building and slowly building suspense until it's nighttime and it's raining and the electrics go down and the T-Rex comes out. But that's half of the midpoint of that film, I think, is Mama T-Rex gets out and eats the lawyer off the toilet, right? Spoiler alert on Jurassic Park. But it's the...
had plenty of time to do it.
Yeah. If there's anybody listening to this podcast who somehow missed Jurassic Park, stop the podcast now. Go watch Jurassic Park.
You got the one guy who in 93 just was like, what? They did what now with dinosaurs? What?
I'm curious in this creature horror film, but I've never seen Jurassic Park. Anyway, my point is that so I think that there's good reason audiences aren't going to be I think, like, disappointed that it takes a long time to get to back to, oh, and now people are getting killed again.
I don't think they will. I don't think they're going to have any reason to be disappointed. They're in for a fun time. I enjoy it myself. Like, as somebody who's been, we were talking off mic how I've been like running around with a head, like a chicken with its head cut off. It was nice to sit back with a film that just embraced the irreverent, embraced the madness, and just had fun with itself. It was a great treat. I want to know, though, how other people can experience this film. What is the plan here? Where does it go at this point? Where are we
going? Okay. Somehow we did get a distributor. The movie is coming out on actual platforms, which feels crazy. I think after somewhere in the 7 years of editing, most of the people who worked on it just thought this was disappearing and never getting finished. And when I was like, hey, I finished the movie, everyone was like, what movie? What the hell are you talking about? It is coming out. We made a movie. It's a real movie. And it's coming out April 19th on VOD. And so it'll be on Apple, Amazon, Google, and then all the everything else, the ones with really, really funny names, Hoopla, Voodoo, Fandango, or whatever. yeah. So it'll be on all the really fun stuff on VOD for the in time to celebrate your 420 weekend, Friday, April 19th.
I'm sober myself, but I think people who do engage in the sticky icky will quite enjoy what you have to offer them.
It's got a lot of I don't think of it as a stoner comedy, but our distributor does. And it's sort of, you know, it's got a lot of features of that kind of irreverent, absurdist, psychedelic humor.
I think additionally, not just within that 420 vibe, I think you do manage to weave a fun tale of comedy horror that does have fun with its premise. Like the joy of making the film is all over the film. It's not,
yeah.
There's no cynicism involved. There's no, nobody feels dishonest on screen, and the film itself doesn't feel dishonest. So that honesty, I think, is going to bleed into people checking out the film, my friend.
Thank you so much, because that is so much the intention behind this was just like, let's make a movie, let's have as much fun. I feel like this movie has big people pleaser energy too, where it's like, I don't want to, like, we're so hyper conscious, we don't want to waste anybody's time. Everything has to be good and funny in it. Like, let's just make it the absolute best that we can. I think that there's a lot of times where super low budget comedy horrors, and some of them are great and I enjoy them still, but like, are like, well, this can be bad. Right. Like, or we can sort of own intentionally being bad, or call it parody and have that part be bad or whatever. And maybe that's like cynicism, like you're saying, like that was not our attempt. Our attempt was like, this movie is silly, this movie is zany, but we are going to commit 100% to making it as legitimately good as we possibly can.
Maybe this is a good way to wrap it up, is like, if this film were trying to be a parody or trying to poke fun at itself too much, I don't think that the heart of the Woody character would be in full fashion. Like, it's so weird. Like, the thing that I notice is like the performance of Woody is this very like grounded, sounds like he maybe comes from the East Coast, interdimensional being stuck in a napkin does have like feelings for the people he's surrounded with. He cares about Sam. He cares about the people in his life. Like, I love the whole idea is like, no, Sam, I know I try to like con you into cleaning up messes, but this is where you have to go. Like that, I think if you were to make the Woody character like not give a crap, then the movie wouldn't work. And the fact that he doesn't give a crap about the people that he's interacting with, it's kind of like the Muppets. Like, if you don't believe that you're talking to Kermit the Frog, this premise doesn't work. And so I do think that you've built something that's genuine on this footing. So I think it's a good achievement, sir.
Thank you so much. I think another piece of like what makes Woody work as well as he does, I mean, it's a whole ensemble is so good around him that them playing the actor, human actors playing off him, I think is a huge piece, especially Jacob DeMonifin, who plays Sam, who has all of these emotional scenes with Woody. And like, I think he's a very talented actor, right? Like, and his ability to sell the seriousness of this relationship that he has with his handkerchief. Like, I think we really believe that they have like a 30 year history or whatever, 20 something years of like backstory between them and this whole relationship. And there's a lot a lot of pressure was put on Jacob to really sell that as the human half of the pair.
He provides just enough vulnerability to make that role work.
Right.
It's actually he's got a very like I admire the timidness he brought to the performance, and then how it builds, because at a certain point when they're talking about not mentioning the mutated head on the back of that woman, like that was probably my favorite like character interaction in the movie, going like, you could have said something about it. Like it's that vulnerability. If he doesn't sell it, then the movie doesn't work. And if the puppet doesn't sell his sincerity, then the movie doesn't work. Everybody is very sincere about the job that they're performing.
Even when they're doing silly stuff, I think they're doing it as if it's these actors really committed hard to the bit.
Agreed. Well, before we go, remind everybody, I know you talked about it, but do it again, because we want to get people to watch this film. Where are they able to find it? When is it coming out? How can they watch it?
So April 19th, everywhere online. I think you just Google it and it comes up. Amazon will probably be the most reliable place to find it, you know, but it'll also be on Apple TV, Google Play, whatever Vudu is called in a couple of weeks. Fandango, I think.
Pending, you know. Home again. What? Homeward Bound. Pending.
I don't know. Whenever I want to watch anything, I just Google it now to figure out where to watch it, because I have no idea where anything is. So.
Yeah, I understand.
I think probably people can do that. You can also find us at hankypankythemovie.com. And if you screw up and just type hankypankymovie.com, guess what? I bought both domains. So you're good. Hanky Panky Movie, not to be confused with Hanky Panky the Underwear, which is apparent. We didn't know this at the time. There's a big underwear company called Hanky Panky. So we're not winning the SEO battle with them yet. But hopefully one day.
Never say never. All we got to wait for is either, the film should blow up, but if it doesn't for whatever reason, we just got to wait for Hanky Panky Underwear to collapse under itself, and then they'll be gone.
Yeah. Or better, some kind of partnership for the sequel, guys. You know what I mean? It could be Hanky Panky Presents Hanky Panky 2.
Is there a sequel in mind? That may be.
Oh, the whole thing is in my head. The movie exists. It's up here. And it goes much harder. Let's just say there are more hats. There are more hankies. It's just more of everything. It's Independence Day, like on acid.
Nice. Fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Nick, for sitting down to chat with us about your film. We were so happy to talk with you. Brad, I think that's going to wrap it up for this real interview. Should we switch it over back to the main programming?
Or just the regular programming, because we might have just put this on YouTube without the rest of the show. I do have one question though.
Oh yeah.
Which you've been talking the whole time. The Cheers references, obviously you must be huge Cheers fans.
No, I hate Cheers. No, yeah. the Cheers thing came out of when we initially did the short film. It was for one of those like projects where you have 48 hours to make a movie. And so we were like, okay, we got 48 hours and we got a character named Sam. And I was like, I got to name all these other characters. I don't have time to name them. So I was like, Diane, Cliff, Carlo, Woody, go as a, like a placeholder. But then once it was a placeholder, I was like, that's actually very funny. Let's commit to that. And, just make every character in the movie named after the characters from Cheers. That is the end of where I think the Cheers references go.
Well, but it's the logo of the movie.
But of course, the logo of the film is, it's the Cheers font, but then it flies in space like Star Wars, and it's got music that is reminiscent of The Shining. We're like, I think it's pretty clear. We're just like, we're all over the place movie buffs and film and television lovers who, very freely picked and chose. All kinds of references.
That's cool. I like it.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much again, Nick. And that's going to wrap it up for this real interview. Dig back over to realnerdspodcast.com and check us out on all of our socials to hear more real interviews, as well as our movie reviews, our film explosions, etc. All that wonderful stuff at Real Nerds Podcast. Until next time, bye. Well, a real nerd knows who shot a real nerd.
Thanks for listening to Real Nerds Podcast, a Nebulous Visions production. Stream or download episodes, read articles at realnerdspodcast.com. Stream us on Apple or Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or iHeartRadio. Follow us on Facebook, Real Nerds Podcast, Twitter and Instagram, at Real Nerds. Watch us on YouTube, Real Nerds Podcast. Email us at realnerds@gmail.com. Call us at 720-6NERDS5. Thank you to Sparks Mandrill, Mike at Plan 9 Studios, and Bolognium for all of our groovy theme songs. And that's how you fucking do it.